If you wish to become a complete and wise leader, you must embrace a larger view of the Force.
And welcome, everyone. My name is DeVore, and you are listening to episode 13 of A Larger View of the Force, a Star Wars podcast. A reminder, as always, check out the earlier episodes of this show if you're new here, and make sure to subscribe to keep up with new episodes of the show as they come out. For today's show, I'm picking up where I left off in episode 12 and continuing my look at The Mandalorians. Though this time, I'm not going to be just looking at season 2 of The Mandalorian, although that's going to be a big part of the episode. Instead, I'm going to be looking at the whole sweep of Mandalorian storytelling that we currently have in canon, beginning with Clone Wars and then continuing through Rebels and up to The Mandalorian. I mentioned this at the end of the last episode. The Mandalorians are probably one of the most fleshed out people in Star Wars, in terms of how much we know about their history and society and culture. And there's a couple big threads running through that story. We see that Mandalorian society's got a lot of factions in it. We see that there are a number of competing worldviews in terms of what it means to be a Mandalorian and how to live your life. We see a lot of conflict, both internally among Mandalorians and also conflict against Mandalorians visited upon them by outside actors. And then we also see Mandalorians who've been displaced, oftentimes by that conflict. And we follow them as they try to carve out a life for themselves away from their homeland. And in some cases, we see them struggling to try and get back to home. This episode is about a part of the world that's got a lot in common with Mandalore, and just so happens to be where I'm from. A country that no longer exists, a country that was torn apart by war, and that is Yugoslavia. I'll start off the episode by walking through an admittedly very condensed history of Yugoslavia. It's a pretty complicated place, but I've went ahead and done my level best to simplify it to the best of my abilities. So have no fear, I promise you won't get lost through this. And after that, I'll talk about how my parents and I were forced to flee after the outbreak of civil war in the early 1990s, and how that shaped my own life and my own identity, and the parallels that I see between my own experience and that of the Mandalorians. All right, on that note, let's dig into it. So before we talk any sort of history, we got to just first situate ourselves in place. So the country that was once Yugoslavia was in a region that is known as the Balkans, so that is in southeastern Europe. Yugoslavia comprised what is today, depending on who you ask, either 6 or 7 independent countries. And those are Bosnia, which is where I'm from, Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia, Montenegro, Macedonia, and Kosovo. Kosovo is the asterisk. There are some folks who recognize the independence of Kosovo and some people who do not. So it's a contentious thing depending on where you are and who you ask. So that's why I say 6 or 7. Each of those countries corresponds roughly to a particular ethnic group. So that is to say, the population of Serbia is predominantly ethnically Serbs. The population of Croatia is predominantly ethnically Croatian. Ditto with Slovenia and Macedonia and such. There are two exceptions, two little complicated cases. The first is one that I just mentioned, the one with the asterisk, and that is Kosovo. So Kosovo, most of the population of Kosovo is ethnically Albanian, but the country and the region has had close historic ties to Serbia and for a long time was part of Serbia. And so they ended up declaring independence in the 2000s and Serbia didn't recognize their independence, but they are internationally recognized. So Kosovo is kind of a tricky situation in that regard. The other exception or the other complicated case is the place where I'm from, and that's Bosnia. So what you see in Bosnia is that there are 3 major ethnic groups living within the boundaries of Bosnia. So on the one hand, you've got Bosnian Serbs, so Serbs who live in Bosnia. You've got Bosnian Croats, so basically folks who are ethnically Croatian, but they live in Bosnia. And then you've got a third group that are known as Bosniaks. And so those are essentially Bosnian Muslims. And one of the things that you see in the countries of the former Yugoslavia that is in some ways something of a kind of unique or particular feature of the region is that there's a very, very close relationship between ethnic and religious identities. In a lot of cases, those go hand in hand or they're closely associated with one another. So for instance, if you look, for example, at the population of Croatia, Croatia is religiously predominantly Catholic. So there's a strong correlation relationship between Croats and Catholicism. In the case of the Serbs, the population of Serbia is predominantly Eastern Orthodox. So you have that close historic relationship between the ethnic Serb population and the Eastern Orthodox Church. And then in Bosnia with the Bosniaks, as I just mentioned, they are Bosnian Muslims. So you've got there again, ethnic and religious identity closely related to one another. The term Yugoslav or Yugoslavia literally means Southern Slav or South Slav. And it was a country that was created in the aftermath of World War I. Yugoslavia as an entity, as an idea, didn't really exist prior to that point. So in order to tell the story of Yugoslavia and how Yugoslavia came to be, and then ultimately how Yugoslavia fell apart in the 1990s, we have to go all the way back to the 19th century. As I said, fear not, stick with me. I will walk you through this. You will not get lost. If you fell asleep in your European history class, don't worry, I am here to hold your hand and walk you through all of this. So if we go back to the 19th century, what we see is that the Balkans were kind of a hot zone in Europe. And that was for two big reasons. So the first major reason is that the Balkans were a contact zone between two of Europe's oldest and most prominent and most powerful empires. So to the north of the Balkans, you had the Austrian Empire, later known as Austria-Hungary. And then to the south of the Balkans, you had the Ottoman Empire, you had Turkey. And so the borders of those two empires met in the Balkans. And so naturally with, as is the case with any kind of borderland zone, any place where you have contact between two large geopolitical entities, there's bound to be a lot of tension and warfare and strife and so on. So that's one factor. It's basically these kind of imperial big power politics. The other reason why the Balkans were such a hot zone in the 19th century is the rise of nationalism, which is something that was happening all throughout Europe. And so what you see, if you look at a map of Europe, particularly in the late 19th century, what you'll see is that there are a lot fewer countries on it compared to Europe today, or even Europe in the middle of the 20th century. You've got these big hulking empires all throughout Europe. You've got Germany in the late 19th century. You've got the Austrian Empire. You've got the Ottomans to the south. You've even got the Russians all the way to the east. And a lot of these empires were multi-ethnic, which is to say you had a number of national and ethnic minorities living within the borders of these empires. So if you look at like the Austrian Empire, for example, you had Germans, you had Austrians, but you also had Hungarians, you had Poles, you had Czechs, you had Slovakians. And so what you start to see in the 19th century is you start to see the emergence of nationalism, of this idea that all of these national and ethnic groups should have states of their own. And so within these massive empires, you start to see the emergence of these nationalist movements that are calling for, in some cases, greater autonomy, and in some cases, outright independence. And that starts rocking a lot of the internal dynamics of these bigger countries. And you see this in particular in the Balkans, but not just exclusively there. So, for example, in the 1810s, you see a revolution that breaks out in Serbia, which at the time was still part of the Ottoman Empire. In the next decade, in the 1820s, you see a revolution break out in Greece, which is also at the time still part of the Ottoman Empire. In the 1870s, you see revolutions break out in Bulgaria and Albania. And so what this means, for instance, in the case of the Ottoman Empire, is that over the course of the 19th century, it starts to lose territory on its northern borders. A lot of these Balkan countries start breaking apart, or they start declaring independence. And so what we see in the late 19th century in the Balkans is that both of these two dynamics, on the one hand, imperial politics, great power politics, and then on the other hand, this nationalist agitation that is starting to happen, those two forces will come smacking into one another in some really, really consequential ways. So in 1878, you have the end of a war that broke out between Russia and the Ottoman Empire, and you have this peace treaty that is hammered out, bring the war to a formal end, and that is the Treaty of Berlin. And the Treaty of Berlin contains a number of different provisions, but one of them has to do with territory in the Balkans. And so one of the most significant elements of the Treaty of Berlin is that it gives the Austrians, it gives Austria-Hungary, control over the Ottoman province of Bosnia. So basically, Bosnia remains nominally a part of the Ottoman Empire, but Austria is given a kind of controlling interest over it. This arrangement lasts for about 30 years, almost exactly 30 years. In 1908, Austria moves to formally annex Bosnia. So that is to say, rather than basically having this arrangement whereby Bosnia is still part of the Ottoman Empire, but Austria has this rule over it, Austria basically just steps in and says, we're just going to take Bosnia, or we're just going to absorb it into our own empire. Now, for Austria, that was a move, because Austria was dealing with a lot of internal strife and tension with a lot of the ethnic minorities in their own borders, in particular among the Hungarians, but not just among the Hungarians. So the notion of, in the midst of all that, adding yet another part of Europe with another population of ethnic minorities into that mix, not the smartest idea in the long term. In the short term, the annexation of Bosnia triggered a major international crisis throughout Europe. And it angered a number of different parties. Naturally, as you can imagine, the Ottomans were none too happy about losing one of their territories. But one group that was particularly incensed at Austria's move was Serb nationalists. So as I just alluded to a couple of minutes ago, there was a large Serb population living in Bosnia. And those Serbs wanted to be a part of the independent nation of Serbia. They didn't want to be part of either the Ottoman Empire or the Austrian Empire. And what you see among a lot of Serb nationalists in the early 20th century is one of their major goals is to create what they called a quote-unquote greater Serbia. So there was this vision of having Serbia absorb the territory in Bosnia where the Serb populations lived, and basically creating this larger state that encompassed all Serbian people wherever they were in the Balkans. And so naturally, Austria's move of annexing Bosnia went in direct contradiction to their goal. And so what you see as we start getting into the 19-teens is we see the Balkans becoming increasingly tense and conflict-prone zone. In fact, in the years 1912 and 1913, so literally right before World War I, you see two wars breaking out in the Balkans. And these are all essentially wars over territory. So on the one hand, you've got fighting between the Ottoman Empire and a lot of their former territories, so countries like Serbia and Greece and Bulgaria. And then you also have fighting among a lot of these Balkan countries, because they're all kind of jockeying for territory, and they're all being like, well, our people are living within the borders of your country, so we want to take that territory from you so that they can be part of our nation. And so you have a lot of fighting over these nationalist territorial claims. All of this ultimately crescendos in the part of the story that I would wager most listeners know best, which is in June of 1914. In that month, Franz Ferdinand, who is the Archduke of the Austrian Empire, he is the heir apparent to the throne, he visits Sarajevo, which is the capital of Bosnia, and while there, he and his wife are assassinated by a group known as the Black Hand. And the Black Hand was a Serb nationalist terrorist group that wanted a greater Serbia. So it was one of those nationalists who were wanting to have Bosnia become a part of this larger Serb nation. And so they ultimately decided to orchestrate the assassination of the Archduke and his wife as a way to demonstrate their opposition to Austria's annexation of Bosnia, and basically as a way to try and get Austria ultimately to leave Bosnia. And again, as most of the listeners to the show are probably already aware, the assassination of Franz Ferdinand triggers a political crisis that ultimately culminates in the outbreak of the First World War. So World War I lasts from 1914 to 1918, and in 1918 you have the Treaty of Versailles. And the Treaty of Versailles does a number of different things, which for our purposes we're not really that interested in. The most important part of it that we are interested in, though, is that the treaty breaks up a lot of these big European empires. So the German Empire, the Austrian Empire, the Ottomans, they're all basically broken apart. And you see the creation of new countries who are created on the basis of the concept of national self-determination. So this is an idea that is introduced into the peace conference by President Woodrow Wilson. Basically, this idea that all of these different ethnic and national groups have the right to create states for themselves. And so what you see in the aftermath of World War I is that the map of Europe gets a lot more crowded. You have a bunch of new countries. So you have countries like Czechoslovakia. You have a much smaller Austria. You have an independent Hungary. You have an independent Poland. And you also have a Yugoslavia. What's interesting about Yugoslavia, though, that makes it a little bit different from some of these other ones, from like a Hungary, from your Polands, from your Austrias, is that all of those were states for one specific ethnic or national group. So you got a Hungary for Hungarians, you got a Poland for the Poles, you got an Austria for the Austrians. Yugoslavia, on the other hand, was a pan-national state. So it was a country that encompassed all of these different national and ethnic groups. You had the Slovenians, you had the Serbs, you had the Croats, you had the Macedonians, you had the Bosnians. And so one of the big questions, maybe you could even make the case out, the big question that hung over this new country of Yugoslavia, and that really sort of hung over the whole breadth of the history of Yugoslavia over the course of the 20th century, was basically, what is Yugoslav identity? What is this thing called Yugoslavia? What does it mean to be a Yugoslav? In a way, there were two options, or two routes that were open towards addressing that question. So one possibility, one scenario, one understanding of what Yugoslav identity was or was going to be, was that it would simply constitute dominance by one ethnic group. So Yugoslav identity would simply be defined by, let's say, the Serbs or the Croats, and basically all other ethnic groups within the territories of Yugoslavia would have to sort of subordinate their own identity and their own culture and their own values and their own interests to one particular dominant ethnic group. That was one scenario. The other scenario, the other possibility for what Yugoslav identity was that it was going to be something totally new. It was going to be something that incorporated, something that transcended the pre-existing historical, ethnic, and national ties and identities. And what we're going to see as we start talking about Yugoslavia in the 20th century is that at different points, both options are explored, and ultimately, both options will come to fail for their own particular reasons. What we see in the aftermath of World War I is we see Yugoslavia really entering the first phase of its history, and that is the kingdom stage. So that is the period of time in which it is known as the Kingdom of Yugoslavia, and that lasts from 1918 up to 1941. And what we see in the kingdom period is that this is the period of time in which Yugoslavia really goes down that first route, which is this notion of Yugoslav identity simply constituting dominance by one of the major ethnic groups. And so what we see in the Kingdom of Yugoslavia is that it is a country that is a Serb-dominated monarchy. So Yugoslavia is ruled by the same royal family that had ruled the independent kingdom of Yugoslavia before the outbreak of World War I. They simply just seat themselves as the rulers of this much larger polity. And what ultimately happens as a result of that is that a lot of the governance and policymaking that takes place within the kingdom of Yugoslavia tends to be tilted towards Serb interests. And as a result of that, because of the Serb dominance in the politics and the government of the Kingdom of Yugoslavia, that starts to inflame tensions among the other ethnic minorities, among the Croats, among the other populations. They start to resent the fact that they feel shut out, left out of the actual governance of the country. And so as you get into the 1920s and you get into the 1930s, that starts to manifest itself in the form of a lot of internal political tension within the country. So, for instance, in 1934, you have the assassination of the king of Yugoslavia, a guy by the name of Alexander I. He is murdered by a Macedonian nationalist. You also see in the 1930s the emergence in Croatia of a group known as the Ustasha, and they were essentially a Croatian fascist movement. So they were essentially a group that modeled themselves after the fascists in Italy and the Nazis in Germany, and they start to engage in a lot of political subterfuge. So as you get into the 1930s, Yugoslavia internally is very, very rocky and very, very unstable. And that ultimately makes it prone and vulnerable to collapse in the early 1940s. And that collapse is precipitated by the outbreak of World War II and the invasion of Yugoslavia by the Axis, by Germany and Italy, in 1941. So the Germans and the Italians sweep into the country, and they're able to achieve victory pretty quickly. And what you see in the aftermath of the Axis invasion is that the Kingdom of Yugoslavia is occupied and ultimately carved up. So you have the creation of a number of these Axis-friendly puppet states. So in Croatia, for example, the Germans and the Italians install the Ustasha, that fascist group that was created in the 1930s. They put them in power. They create a new state. It was called the Independent State of Croatia. And what we see in the aftermath of Axis occupation is that a three-way war erupts in Yugoslavia. So you've got this kind of mini war that is happening in what used to be the Kingdom of Yugoslavia, at the same time that you've got the larger war of World War II as the backdrop. So who are the participants in this three-way civil war? So in one corner, you've got basically the fascists. So you've got the Ustasha in Croatia and their associated allies, so chiefly Germany and Italy. In the second corner, you have a group that is known as the Chetniks. And the Chetniks are essentially Serb monarchists. So these were Serbians who were fighting for the restoration of the kingdom of the monarchy that had been deposed following the invasion in 1941. And in the third corner, you've got a group that were known as the Partisans. And the Partisans were communists. They were Yugoslav communists, led by a guy by the name of Josip Broz Tito, who for the rest of this, for our purposes, I'm going to refer simply as Tito. So you've got this fighting that takes place basically among these three groups, all kind of against each other. And what you see is that the fighting in Yugoslavia is incredibly brutal. It is characterized by the perpetration of many, many war crimes, by ethnic cleansing. So you see, for instance, a particularly brutal leg of the Holocaust that takes place in fascist Croatia. You see ethnic cleansing of Muslims at the local level. You see war crimes perpetrated against Croats, against Serbs. So it is a very, very bloody and deadly war. And ultimately, when we get to the end of World War II in 1945, once the dust settles, the Partisans are the ones who ultimately emerge victorious. So the Ustasha and the fascists are defeated. The Chetniks are also ultimately defeated. And the group that is ultimately able to gain power are the Partisans. And so they go ahead in the aftermath of World War II to basically cobble back together the territory of Yugoslavia and to create a new state known as the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia under the rule of Tito. So now we move into the second phase of the history of Yugoslavia. So we've already talked about the kingdom phase that lasted from the end of World War I to the outbreak of World War II. And now we are going to be talking about socialist Yugoslavia, which lasts from 1945 up until the early 90s. So what we see kind of geopolitically in Europe after World War II is that the Soviet Union occupies and sets up friendly communist regimes all across Eastern Europe. Yugoslavia, though itself a communist nation, is a little bit different, kind of stands apart from the rest. So what we see in Yugoslavia is that the communist movement in the country, unlike in a lot of these other places, unlike in, let's say, a Hungary or a Poland or a Romania or Bulgaria, was organic. So it sort of emerged independent of any sort of Soviet influence and involvement and support. And in fact, what we see in Yugoslavia is that it is the only communist movement to rise up and take power without the help of the Soviet Union. So it did not involve the intervention of the Red Army or the Soviet government in any sort of way. The communists in Yugoslavia were able to take power by their own volition. And so that ends up really being important in terms of how Yugoslavia ends up kind of situating itself geopolitically after World War II. Because what you see is that Yugoslavia is initially, like all the other communist states in Eastern Europe, it is allied with the Soviet Union. But what starts to happen pretty quickly in the first few years after 1945 is that Yugoslavia starts insisting on pursuing its own path. That it doesn't want to be under the yoke of Soviet domination and influence. And so what you see happen in 1948, so just 3 years after the end of World War II, is what was known as the Yugoslav-Soviet split. So basically what happens is that Tito essentially takes Yugoslavia out of the Soviet orbit, and Yugoslavia ends up adopting a policy of neutrality between East and West. So although it is a communist state, Yugoslavia ultimately declares that it will not take a side in what is at that time basically the emerging Cold War. It will neither be part of the Soviet camp, nor will it be part of the United States, the Western camp. And once Yugoslavia makes that break and decides to basically be an independent country and pursue its own course, what you see is that it starts to develop its own economic and foreign policy that really doesn't look like any of its neighbor states. So, for example, in the case of the economy, what you see at this time in the late 1940s and then going into the 1950s in the Soviet Union and all of its satellite states in Eastern Europe is you see very, very centralized economies where the government is exercising a very high degree of control over production and manufacture and such. In Yugoslavia, by contrast, what you start to see is the emergence of an alternative system that is known as market socialism. And so basically the system that Yugoslavia develops is one in which all the businesses in the country, or at least the major businesses, are owned by the state, so as they would be in any other communist state at this time. But the businesses themselves are managed directly by the workers who work within them. So you basically have the system of like worker councils that are set up within businesses that workers are able to elect people to, and they basically run these state-owned businesses independently. And what you also see alongside that is you get this kind of mixed system where you have, on the one hand, state control, particularly over like major industries and major companies, but you do also have coexisting alongside that some market mechanisms. So it's this kind of blend of certain elements of the communist Soviet model with these kind of smatterings of market system that you would see, for instance, in the West at this time. So they develop their own hybrid economic model that is unlike what exists in either the Soviet-dominated East at the time or in the capitalist West at the time. In terms of foreign policy, In 1961, you have the creation of an organization that was known as the Non-Aligned Movement, which actually still exists to this day. The Non-Aligned Movement was a union of countries who were not on either side of the Cold War, so they did not ally themselves either with the United States or with the Soviet Union. Yugoslavia was a founding member of the Non-Aligned Movement, along with a number of other countries, including Egypt, India, Ghana, and several others. In addition to these policy moves, in addition to these moves on the economy and on foreign policy to carve out an independent path for itself, one of the other things that you see in Yugoslavia is the emergence of what comes to be called Yugoslavism. Communist Yugoslavia promoted a new Yugoslav identity that transcended ethnicity and religion under the banner of brotherhood and unity. And so what you see in this concept of brotherhood and unity is this idea of, on the one hand, as I just mentioned, turning away from former ethnic and religious identifiers, and instead orienting the nation towards the project of building socialism. And an integral part of that, of both this new Yugoslav identity and of brotherhood and unity, was the creation of a cult of personality around the figure of Tito. And this manifested itself in a lot of different ways. So one of them that my mom used to tell me about is there was this event that took place every single year that was known as the Relay of Youth. And this happened every year on Tito's birthday on May 25th, which was a national holiday. And basically what would happen is there would be this big celebration in Belgrade, which was the capital of Yugoslavia. It's now the capital of Serbia. And there was a stadium where there'd be thousands packed in for the occasion. And there would be this one kid that would be chosen. And this kid would be chosen because they were outstanding or exemplary along some sort of metric. They were deemed worthy. And basically, this child at this celebration in this big stadium in Belgrade would carry this baton. They'd be running. It was almost like the Olympics. And they would have to walk up this like massive like stadium, this like massive like flight of stairs, all the way up to where Tito was sitting. And they would deliver this baton to him. And then once they were up there, and they were like huffing and puffing from having climbed up all the stairs, they would then like recite the speech to the kind of adulation of the crowd. So you had these activities and all of these kind of events and propaganda that were meant to try and encourage and foster this sense of unity and solidarity in the nation. On the flip side of that, and this would come to be relevant in the later years of the history of Yugoslavia, is that unity was also bought through a certain measure of repression of nationalist movements. You did have, even in the socialist years, you did have Croat groups, Serb groups, other groups who were trying to agitate for greater independence or autonomy, or were trying to kind of resist this pan-nationalist unifying project, but they were sort of repressed by the state. The state kind of kept a lid on them. So there were kind of two parts to this unifying project. Ultimately, though, as I suggested towards the beginning of the episode, even this model, even this version of Yugoslavia that was attempted to be built, did not last. So in 1980, Tito, who had been ruling the country since the end of World War II, passed away. And what became pretty clear in the immediate years after Tito's death is that he had been a unifying force. He was, in many ways, the glue that held the nation together. And so, once he died, the country started fracturing very, very quickly. Added on top of that was a pretty severe economic downturn that sort of exacerbated those tensions and made the decline and fall of Yugoslavia all that more rapid. So, for instance, in 1981, so just a year after Tito died, you have an uprising that takes place in Kosovo, and you start seeing calls within the population for an independent Kosovo. And you also see agitation on the part of Serb and Croatian nationalists, and you start seeing the emergence of these nationalist leaders within these respective territories. So two of the most important, and these are individuals who are major figures in the subsequent conflict in the Civil War in the 1990s, one of them was a guy by the name of Slobodan Milosevic. So Slobodan Milosevic was a Serb. He was from Serbia. And he was, you could say, almost a kind of consummate opportunist, which is to say that basically up until the 1980s, he had been a kind of stalwart, loyal, dutiful communist. He had sort of gone along with the party line and the government agenda and all that. And then basically as soon as the tides turned, as soon as the wind shifted in the favor of nationalism, he himself sort of evolved very quickly and took up the cause of Serbian nationalism. And that ultimately rides him into becoming the president of Serbia in the late 1980s. And then on the flip side, in Croatia, you have a similar sort of type of figure, individual that emerges, by a guy by the name of Franjo Tuđman. And he had been a much more kind of committed Croatian nationalist than Milosevic had been a Serb nationalist. So he had been a dissident back in the 1970s. And then once you get into the 80s, he starts kind of coming out of the woodwork and becoming a much more prominent figure. And then ultimately, he too becomes president of Croatia in 1990. And so basically, by the time we get into the late 80s and then in the turn into the 1990s, it becomes pretty clear that Yugoslavia is not going to last for much longer, and that really it's a question of when rather than if the country is going to fall apart. And it turns out that happens very, very quickly into the 1990s. So the first shot comes in June of 1991 when Slovenia secedes. Slovenia's secession results in a pretty small war that lasts about 1 week, but ultimately Slovenia is allowed to leave Yugoslavia. But on its coattails, Croatia ends up declaring independence and tries to break away from Yugoslavia. And then roughly about a year later, in April of 1992, Bosnia itself moves to declare independence and become an independent country. And then by that point, once you've got Croatia and Bosnia in the mix trying to break away, then you have the outbreak of all-out war. So for our purposes, because it's most relevant to this episode and to my own life and such, I'm going to really focus on what happens in the war in Bosnia. So what you see in Bosnia is an interesting situation where, on the one hand, you've got all of these kind of constituent states of Yugoslavia that were trying to break away, the Slovenians first, then the Croats, and then Bosnia. And then within Bosnia, once war actually starts happening, is that you've got populations within Bosnia that are trying to break up the country into even smaller parts. So you've got both Serbs and Croats in Bosnia, who are living in Bosnia, who are trying to create their own states. So they're basically trying to carve out a Bosnian-Croat state out of Bosnia, or a Bosnian-Serb state out of Bosnia. And so you have these self-declared nations that kind of emerge within Bosnia, and they're kind of trying to break away and trying to join either Serbia or Croatia. So you've got this kind of large-scale breaking apart that happens in Yugoslavia, and then you have this kind of smaller-scale breaking apart that happens in Bosnia. And with that, you see fighting breaking out between the armed forces of all these nations, so the formal Bosnian army against the Serb army, against the Croats and such, as well as fighting that takes place between and among nationalist paramilitary groups. So what you start to see is on the ground, you start to see, let's say, whether it's the Bosnian Serbs, the Bosnian Croats, they start to organize their own, let's say, like militia-type groups who start involved in fighting kind of outside of the regular armed forces of all these nations. And the fighting in Bosnia is very, very intense and very, very brutal. So in April of 1992, so basically the same time that Bosnia declares independence from Yugoslavia proper, you have the siege of Sarajevo. So the capital of Bosnia comes under siege. It lasts for over 1,400 days. Over 5,000 civilians are killed in the course of the siege. You have civilians getting shot by rooftop snipers that essentially establish themselves on the tops of buildings and start kind of picking people off as they're walking down the street or exiting buildings. You have bombardments that kill large numbers of people. And throughout Bosnia, you have campaigns of ethnic cleansing. So probably the most infamous instance of this takes place in July of 1995 in a village in Bosnia called Srebrenica. And there you see over 8,000 Bosnian Muslims are rounded up and exterminated. It is the worst genocide in Europe since the Holocaust. And then beyond just Srebrenica, you see smaller massacres that take place in other towns and villages and cities all across Bosnia. You also see forced migration. So you see people being forced to flee their homes and move to other parts of the country as their homes and their towns and the cities get taken over by some of these paramilitary groups. So it was a very dark time, very, very dark time in the country and in the region. Ultimately, in the fall of 1995, you have intervention on the part of the United States and NATO that ultimately brings the war in Bosnia to an end. So in December of 1995, you have the signing of the Dayton Accords that takes place in Dayton, Ohio, that brings peace to Bosnia. And so by basically the mid-90s, the region is in a kind of tentative peace. Yugoslavia is now gone by this point. You now have a bunch of separate nations. But you do see conflict emerge later in the decade. So in 1998, you have the outbreak of war in Kosovo, and that results in yet another NATO intervention to put a stop to that. And so basically, by the time we get to the end of the century, by the time we get to 2000, the region is finally at a kind of stable peace. All right, history lesson over. For those of you who have not shut off the podcast by this point and are still sticking through with me, thank you. I promise we will now talk more about Star Wars. So the reason that I took you on this grand historical tour is that a lot of the major through lines of Yugoslav history, so issues around culture and identity and factionalism, civil war, displacement, old ways versus new ways, these also run through the history of Mandalore and the Mandalorians. So for instance, think about where we first meet the Mandalorians in the Clone Wars under Duchess Satine. What we see under Satine at that time is something not unlike what we see in Yugoslavia under Tito in the communist phase, which is to say that Satine, much like Tito, was trying to chart a new course for Mandalore. So as we know, in the case of Satine, she rose to power after the Mandalorian Civil War, again, much like Tito, right? There's that parallel about internal conflict and then emerging out of it. And she becomes the leader of this group that is known as the New Mandalorians. And so these Mandalorians are defined by their rejection of the Mandalorian warrior heritage and the embrace of pacifism instead. And also what we see with Satine is during the Clone War, she tries to chart this path of neutrality. She tries to not take the side of either the Republic or the Separatists. Again, very similar to the situation in communist Yugoslavia, where you've got like the new Yugoslav identity on the other hand that is trying to be carved out. And then you've also got this path of neutrality where they're trying to take a third way during the Cold War. Similarly, during the Clone Wars, Satine is trying to take a third way, neither with the Republic or with the Separatists. And so we see that at multiple different points in the Clone Wars. There's that one episode where she tries to organize a peace conference between the Republic and the Separatists. We see just how challenging and how fraught her effort to create a neutral path for Mandalore is, right? She's the victim of a number of assassination attempts and various sorts of schemes to try and get the Republic to intervene in Mandalore that we see across a number of episodes over the course of the Clone Wars. And what we also see in Satine's Mandalore, not unlike what you see in Tito's Yugoslavia, is there are also the presence of internal forces that are causing tension and discord. So in the case of the Mandalorians, that is Death Watch. And what we see with Death Watch is they are the defenders of the quote-unquote old ways, and they are attempting to overthrow Satine. So they are actively pushing against this new this effort to create a kind of new Mandalorian identity and trying to return Mandalore to its earlier heritage, not unlike some of the nationalist groups that you have in Yugoslavia, who are also trying to reject this Brotherhood and Unity project and trying to embrace these older national religious and ethnic identities. And what we ultimately see in the Clone Wars is that the new Mandalore, much like the new Yugoslavia of post-World War II, ultimately fell due to those internal pressures. So what we see in the Clone Wars is Death Watch creates this alliance with Darth Maul and the Shadow Collective. Maul ultimately becomes the ruler of Mandalore by dueling Pre Vizsla. And I think in a lot of ways, if you think about that comparison between Mandalore and Yugoslavia, you could see Maul as akin to some of these nationalist figures that emerged in Yugoslavia in the 1980s. So somebody like a Milosevic or somebody like a Tudjman. Maul, like those individuals, he sensed an opportunity to exploit the factionalism in Mandalore and a lot of this internal tension that was going on the planet to his own advantage in order to ultimately assist in his own rise to power in the same way that a lot of these nationalist figureheads do in Yugoslavia in the 1980s. And what we ultimately see by the time we get to season 5 in the Clone Wars is that Satine's death, much like Tito's death, marks the end of the experiment with a new way and the reassertion of tradition. So in the same way that after Satine, Mandalore kind of reverts to its warrior past, we see in Yugoslavia after Tito dies, a lot of these nationalist sentiments reemerge. So after the events of Clone Wars, the next time that we see Mandalore in canon is in Star Wars Rebels, when it is under the rule of the Empire. And on Rebels, we're introduced to a couple new Mandalorian factions. So we've got, on the one hand, the Imperial Super Commandos. So those are the Mandalorians who were loyal to the Empire. They were led by Gar Saxon. You've also got the Protectors on Concord Dawn, who were led by Fenn Rau. And I think when we look at Mandalore and Rebels, I think we can see some parallels with Yugoslavia during World War II. So if you look at, for instance, at the Imperial Super Commandos, you can see a kind of similarity between them and, let's say, the Ustasha, those Croatian fascists who were allied with Nazi Germany and with fascist Italy. And as with the case in Yugoslavia, both in World War II and then also in the Civil War in the 1990s, we see the perpetration of what you could describe as efforts at ethnic cleansing or genocide. So in Rebels, we see that the Empire develops this weapon called the Duchess that targets Mandalorian armor, essentially allows them to disintegrate Mandalorians alive. And then we haven't seen this on screen as of yet, but we do know it from The Mandalorian that following Bo-Katan's return to power, when Sabine gives her the Darksaber, the Empire initiates what we know as the Great Purge. So one of the consequences of all of this conflict that we've been talking about so far in this episode, both the fictional ones that occur in the world of Star Wars on Mandalore, and then also the very real conflict that took place in Yugoslavia, is the creation of a population of refugees. So that's what we're going to move on to talking about next, which is the refugees of Yugoslavia and of Mandalore. Before we get into particulars, though, I want to make a conceptual difference. So I want to distinguish between immigrants on the one hand and refugees on the other. The two terms are related, but they are distinct. So an immigrant, put simply, is someone who moves from one country to live in another. A refugee is a subset of that. And so I'm going to use the United Nations definition of what a refugee is. And that is, quote, someone who is unable or unwilling to return to their country of origin owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion. So the defining feature of a refugee, in other words, is displacement. Refugees are forced by circumstance to leave the country in which they live and to move to another one. And that displacement can be either temporary or permanent. So in some cases, refugees, let's say, leave their home country in the midst of a civil war, an invasion, something like that. And then when peace returns, they come back. In other cases, it's permanent. They leave and they don't have a return for one reason or another. Many of the Mandalorians that we meet in Star Wars at one point or another qualify as refugees. So Bo-Katan, when we see her in Rebels, and then again when we see her in The Mandalorian, Sabine Wren, Din Djarin, the Armorer, they are all displaced by different sorts of conflicts. And I keep harping on this point about displacement because it's really, really important, and it's really, really central to the rest of the narrative that I'm going to tell. The fact of displacement, the fact that refugees are forced to leave their homelands, means that refugees have a unique relationship both to the places from which they have had to leave, as well as the places in which they ultimately wind up, that separates them from other sorts of immigrants, and that kind of marks them out as distinct. So all refugees are by definition immigrants, but not all immigrants are refugees because that displacement component may or may not be there, and it's very, very important. So to illustrate how it's important, I will turn at long last to telling my own story. I mentioned that part of the reason that I told the history of Yugoslavia was so that I could tease out all of these similarities between Yugoslavia on the one hand and Mandalore on the other. But there's another reason I went as deep as I did in the history, which is that my own family's history intersects with the history of Yugoslavia itself at some pretty crucial moments. So for instance, my dad's family, they originally hailed from Hungary, and they moved to Bosnia after the annexation that took place early in the 20th century. So that was when Austria formally absorbed Bosnia into its own borders. My great-grandmother, or one of my great-grandmothers on my mother's side, served as a partisan during World War II. So she was a communist insurgent fighter. I have not been able to get any confirmation from my mom's side of the family if she had a body count, but I'm assuming she killed at least some people. My maternal grandparents, so my mom's parents, they had a really interesting relationship, or they have a really interesting relationship because they're still alive. They came from families of different religious backgrounds. So my grandfather, on my mother's side, came from a Eastern Orthodox family, and my grandmother came from a Muslim family. And her family, my grandmother's family, was opposed to my grandmother and my grandfather getting married because they were from different religious backgrounds. And so because of that opposition, my grandmother ultimately eloped. She ran away to marry my grandfather. And there was, in fact, an article in the local newspaper after she eloped. And I'm so bummed that like nobody saved a clipping of this newspaper. But apparently the headline in the local newspaper after the elopement happened was, "Local beauty runs for love." And so after my grandmother ran away to marry my grandfather, her dad, so my great-grandfather, organized essentially like a posse on horseback to bring her back home in order to put a stop to this marriage. Ultimately, though, the marriage was allowed to proceed because a local Communist Party official basically intervened in this family dispute and essentially insisted that the marriage had to be allowed to proceed. And the reason that this party official gave was that under the new Yugoslavia, under this new communist state, these religious differences that to my great-grandparents were so important were no longer considered relevant. So you couldn't bar a marriage on the fact that one person was from an Orthodox family and another person was from a Muslim family, because those lines didn't matter anymore. They were building a new identity, brotherhood and unity, as I talked about a few minutes ago, where you're transcending all the former divisions along religious or ethnic or national lines, and you're crafting this new identity. And this is one of the reasons that I really love studying history, is seeing that relationship between the macro and the micro. So in terms of the macro level, you've got the whole state apparatus of Yugoslavia that is crafting this ideology that is centered on pan-national unity and identity and solidarity. And the effects of that are trickling all the way down to the ground level, such that you've got a local Communist Party official intervening in a family dispute and allowing a marriage to take place that otherwise would not have been allowed to take place, therefore allowing my grandmother and grandfather to get married, therefore allowing my mother to be born, therefore allowing me to be born. So my existence ultimately is due to the state ideology of communist Yugoslavia. And ultimately, much like my grandmother and grandfather's marriage, my own parents and my own family was what would be referred to as a quote-unquote mixed marriage. So my dad's family, on that side of the family, they came from what was a Roman Catholic family. And then, of course, as I just talked about with my mom's side of the family, they were a mixed family. They came from a Orthodox Muslim marriage. And they ultimately had me. So I was born in Bosnia, what ultimately became Bosnia, in the fall of 1991. It was still Yugoslavia at the time. My birth certificate says that I was born in the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. And I was born in a small city in eastern Bosnia that is called Bjelina. So it's roughly about an hour and a half west of Belgrade, which is the capital of Serbia. So if you fly into Belgrade and then you basically drive straight west for about an hour and a half, you'll eventually cross the border into Bosnia, and then you'll eventually hit Bjelina. My family, with their mixed circumstances, embodied in a lot of ways the promise of the quote-unquote new Yugoslavia, this notion of transcending old ethnic and religious divisions. But once the war broke out in the early 90s and all of those divisions reasserted themselves, suddenly being a mixed family became very dangerous. Because essentially all signs were out for you and no one really wanted to claim you. So you were in this kind of liminal gray zone, and that was a dangerous place to be in when bullets are flying from either side. And so as a result of that, my parents and I left Bosnia in the fall of 1992, so just before I turned a year old. And it kind of happened through very serendipitous circumstances. So my dad happened to have a work permit that allowed him to cross the border back and forth between Bosnia and Serbia. And at the time that we ultimately decided to leave, it was close to expiring. So he soon would lose the ability to cross the borders. And so basically what my mother and father decided to do was that he would cross into Serbia using that work permit while it was still good. He would essentially leave, and then my mother and I would follow behind him one way or another. So it was taking this real gamble. We were separating ourselves, and we did not know for certain that we were going to be able to reunite, that we were going to be able to see each other again. And fortunately, ultimately, we were able to. And once we were back together, we left Yugoslavia altogether and we moved to northern Germany. Germany, at the time that the war in Yugoslavia broke out, essentially opened up its borders to refugees from Yugoslavia and admitted large numbers of them in. And the reason that Germany in particular did that and why they had that commitment, that itself was a function of these big macro historical forces, because that commitment to admitting refugees stemmed from the history of World War II and the Holocaust. So again, macro and micro, the fact that the place we moved to after fleeing Yugoslavia was Germany was another one of the consequences of these big historical forces having this trickle-down effect and having this impact all the way down to my life, such that the place that I moved to after fleeing a civil war is Germany and not some other place, and who knows where I would have gone or what would have become of my life if I moved someplace else. So we lived in Germany for about 5 years. So when I started speaking, I actually spoke bilingually. So I spoke both Serbo-Croatian, which is the language of Bosnia. And I also spoke German, and I attended kindergarten towards the kind of later years of our time in Germany. After the Dayton Accords were signed in 1995 and you had the return of peace in Bosnia, Germany started forcing Bosnian refugees to leave the country because the rationale of the German government is that the war is over, peace has returned, the reason that we admitted you is now gone, so just leave and go back. And once that happened, our living situation in Germany got a lot more precarious very quickly. It was a different kind of precariousness from what we had in Yugoslavia, but it was precarious nonetheless, because essentially every couple months we had to, you know, check in with the government and figure out if we were okay to stay or if we had to leave. And then eventually we ultimately did have to leave in 1997. But thankfully, as it happened, the United States had set up this program to allow the admission under refugee status of quote-unquote mixed marriages. So essentially families like mine. And so on that basis, we moved to the United States in the fall of 1997. And we moved to New York State, where we have lived ever since. I mentioned towards the beginning of this episode, I introduced this idea that the reality of displacement means that refugees have a unique relationship both to the places that they leave as well as the places that they end up. And this has been particularly the case for me in my own life, and is something that I think we also see in the world of Star Wars with the Mandalorian refugees that we are introduced to. So for instance, in season 2 of The Mandalorian, in the episode The Heiress, when we learn that Din belonged to this cult known as the Children of the Watch, one of the things that we learn is that the Children of the Watch are dissociated. They're cut off from Mandalore. So we get that scene where Din is in the Mon Calamari restaurant with Bo-Katan and the other Mandalorians, and Bo-Katan is talking about retaking Mandalore, and Din has that line where he says, "That planet is cursed." In addition to Din and the Children of the Watch, we see that other Mandalorians that we meet in Star Wars also have a complicated relationship to home. So for instance, in Star Wars Rebels with Sabine Wren, we learn that she is unable to return to her home due to her involvement with the Empire, and specifically with the creation of the Duchess weapon that a lot of other Mandalorians have turned against her and her family. And what we see in season 3, when she does ultimately go back to Cronist, her family doesn't welcome her back. And in fact, her mother Ursa wants her to leave because her presence there puts their family in danger with Gar Saxon and the Imperial Super Commandos and the other Mandalorians. So we see a number of Mandalorian refugees having this tense, complicated, disconnected relationship with home. And the same is true, I would say, in my own life with where I come from. So I have been back to Bosnia, and specifically to Bielina, the city in which I was born, twice. So once in 2000, and then again in 2007. I still have some extended family who live there. I have an aunt who lives there. I've got some cousins who live there. My grandparents, at least the ones who are still alive, still live there. Other members of my family left, so I've got extended family that live all throughout Europe. I'm the only one who lives in the United States along with my parents, but I've got family in the Netherlands. So my dad's brother and his family, they moved to the Netherlands in the late 80s, so right before the war broke out. I've got family that lives in Germany. I've got family that lives in Sweden, kind of all peppered throughout Europe. Although, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I did speak Serbo-Croatian as a child, I gradually lost it over the course of growing up, and particularly as a result of the multiple moves we had to make. So, you know, we were in Germany, I first had to learn German, and then when we left Germany and moved to the United States, I had to learn English. So each time as I learned a new language, my knowledge and comprehension of the earlier languages kind of degraded. So to this day, I can understand Serbo-Croatian pretty well. I have a pretty good listening comprehension of it, but I can't really speak it. I can't really engage in conversation. I can just know what other people are saying for the most part. And that language barrier was part of what ultimately prevented me from developing a close relationship to my extended family, so to my grandparents and to my aunts and uncles and to my cousins, because I couldn't really communicate with them all that well, if at all. I couldn't have a real conversation with them. And so I never was really able to develop a bond with them. I used to think it was only that. Like, I thought the fact that I was kind of disconnected from my extended family could just be reduced solely to language. The fact that they spoke Serbo-Croatian and I didn't, and I spoke English and they didn't. But as I've gotten older, I've realized that there's another kind of layer on top of that. It's part of the story, but it's not the entire story, and it may not be even the most important part of the story. Because, for instance, my cousins, who are essentially of my generation or slightly older than me, they speak English very well. They have a very good comprehension of it. But I'm not close with them either. I'm every bit as kind of removed from them as I am from my aunts and my uncles and my grandparents, who basically don't speak a lick of English. And so what I've come to realize is that even bigger than the language barrier separating us is the barrier of culture. And you can maybe even say the barrier of distance and time, which is to say that life in America versus life in Bosnia, or even life in the Netherlands or Germany or Sweden or wherever my other extended family are, is very different. We lead very, very different lives in very, very important ways. And so that ultimately makes for little on which we are able to communicate and relate. Because at the end of the day, in order to communicate effectively with somebody, you need not just a shared language, but you also need some shared reference. You need something to be able to talk about that you have in common that you can relate to. And if that's not there, even if you have the nominal ability to communicate with someone, there's nothing really to talk about. So I've ultimately come to the conclusion that I probably wouldn't be close with my extended family, even if we did all speak the same language, even if I, let's say, were fluent in Serbo-Croatian or they were fluent in English. I think the fact of that culture barrier being there and all the time that we've spent apart is just something that is very, very difficult, if not impossible, to ultimately overcome. And as a consequence of all of that, both of the language barriers and of the barriers of culture, both of the trips that I went on, both in 2000 and in 2007, were very, very alienating and very, very isolating. Like, those are some of the most lonely times that I felt in my life, because I really felt like a fish out of water situation. I was among these people and I was in this world that I was ostensibly from, but that I had very little tangible connection to, because I wasn't part of the culture and I also didn't have the language with which to communicate. I do want to go back to Bosnia at some point. Particularly, I want to go visit Sarajevo, the capital, because it is a very historical city. It's rich with a lot of culture. I do actually have some extended family who do live there, so I might see them when and if I go. But in all honesty, probably won't ever return to Bielina. I don't see a reason why I would go. I mean, maybe something might come up one day, but I think the betting odds are likely that I will probably never return, especially as, you know, my family ages and my eldest family members pass away. There'll be fewer and fewer reasons as the years go on to return. So I probably won't go back. Probably 2007 will be the last time that I've set foot in Bielina. I think there's very good odds of that. So that's one aspect of the refugee experience, or part of the refugee experience, that I felt in my life, and as I talked about before, that we also see with our Mandalorian refugees in Star Wars, which is this complicated relationship to home, to the places where they come from. Another big facet that has been a part of my life, and that I think we see reflected in the stories of the Mandalorians, is the struggle to find and preserve and maintain one's identity while living in the diaspora, essentially, while essentially being away from the place from which you originate. So in my life, the question, where are you from, is a quite tricky question to answer, and one that, frankly, I dread whenever it comes up, because there's a bunch of ways that I can conceivably answer it. So, for instance, I could say that I'm from New York, which is where I've lived since I moved to the United States. I could also say I'm from America, depending on where I am. I could refer to the larger political entity in which I reside, not just the state in which I reside. I could say I'm from Germany, which is the country from which I directly emigrated. I could say I'm from Bosnia, which is the present-day country in which I was born. I could also say I'm from Yugoslavia, which is the country in which I was actually born, but that doesn't exist anymore. And all of those answers are in their own way right, and all of those answers are in their own way wrong, which is why it makes it such a fraught question for me in particular. Growing up, I often struggled to figure out exactly how to incorporate my refugee experience and that background into my own identity and my own conception of myself. So I remember, particularly when I was young, when I was a teenager in high school, I remember really disliking and resenting having to talk about my past on, say, college applications, when you're like writing personal essays to apply for undergrad. I really kind of resented the fact that like that was the thing that was going to make me, quote unquote, stand out, and the thing that made me kind of unique and different and that might catch some admissions officer's eye. And the reason that I harbored those kind of conflicting negative feelings about talking about my past were really for two reasons. On the one hand, it felt a little bit exploitative. Like I couldn't get over this feeling that I was using this very terrible thing that had happened in the world and in the place that I came from in order to advance some personal cause or agenda. Like it felt a little mucky in that way, and I couldn't totally shake that. The other thing that I didn't like about talking about it was that it wasn't something that I accomplished. It really was just something that happened to me, particularly if we go back to that like college application scenario. I wanted to talk and write about the things that I imagined my peers were talking and writing about, whether it was awards they'd won, teams that they participated in, other sorts of accomplishments. Like I wanted that to be the thing that made me stand out and catch someone's attention, as opposed to this thing, this being a refugee that essentially was a kind of happening to me. It wasn't anything in which I exercised any sort of agency. It was really my parents who like exercised that agency. They decided when to move. They decided where to move to. I was, for all intents and purposes, just luggage. So what all of that is a way of saying is that for a long time, and you can maybe even make the case that is still true to this day, being a refugee is for me something that is on the one hand both profoundly significant and also kind of remote for and to me. It's significant for all the obvious reasons that it's significant, which is that it's impacted every facet of my life. But as I just talked about, like it's also remote in this important way, in the sense that I wasn't aware of any of it at the time. I made no choices. I had no agency. I was just there. Other people made decisions, and then the course of my life was impacted by those decisions. So in that way, it is in this kind of way remote, because it was just this external circumstance bearing down upon me. But as I just mentioned, it was significant, and ultimately, the reality is that I owe my entire sense of self to the fact of my displacement. It is elemental to who I am. Like, no facet of my life would be the same right now if I stayed in Bosnia. I would not be making a Star Wars podcast. You would not be listening to this if the war in Yugoslavia hadn't broken out, or if it had broken out, but my parents had made the decision not to leave and they're basically just stay put and ride it out, which is what lots of people did. So they could have been one of those people, but they weren't. And the fact that they weren't had this whole domino effect leading to this moment. And the other consequence of that is that I think overall, my quality of life, had I stayed in Bosnia, would almost certainly be worse than it is now. Not bad necessarily. I'd probably still have a good life. I'd have friends, I'd have some sort of job. Like, I'd like my life. I would enjoy my life, probably, at least to some degree. But there would definitely be, without a doubt, fewer opportunities compared to the fact that I'm living in the United States and have access to all of these resources and all of these privileges. I wouldn't be doing this show. And that fact, those two facts, I should say, the fact that, one, no facet of my life would be the same if I stayed in Bosnia, and the fact that my life in Bosnia, had I stayed, would be worse than it is now. Those two realities in turn lead to two rather unsettling implications. The first is that it underscores just how fragile and tentative all of our lives are, which is, I think, something that, particularly over the past year with 2020 and the pandemic, I think is something that a lot more people can now relate to versus if I had put out this episode in, let's say, 2019 on the eve of COVID-19. That thing that a lot of people are wrestling with now, where they're realizing, oh my God, like all of this stuff that had been part of my life before the pandemic, whether it was going to bars, going to restaurants, going to the movies, hanging out with friends, hugging other people, that all of that really was on, existed on this very fragile plane and could disappear very quickly as it did. That notion of the fragility of one's life, that is something that refugees, folks like me, that's something that I have been cognizant of for a very long time, for a large part of my life, because I look back and realize just how consequential these very particular decisions at particular points in my life were. And if different decisions were made at those points, my life would look very, very different. So I'm cognizant of the fact that everything that I have now rests on this very fragile foundation. It could have all been very, very different. I could have had none of this. The other unsettling implication is that if it is the case that the life that I have now in the United States is better than the life I would have had if I'd stayed in Bosnia, means that all of the good stuff I've gotten in my life, all the people that I've gotten to meet, all of the opportunities that have been afforded to me, the fact that I'm doing this show, all of that is the result of a very terrible thing happening in world history. All the good that I've had in my life, if you wind the clock back and you go back to the thing that caused it, is actually this really, really shitty thing that happened. So it leads to this very strange dissonance that I have yet really in my life to fully unravel, which is that on a macro level, the civil war in Bosnia was bad. It was obviously bad. Thousands and thousands of people were killed. Lots of people were displaced. It inflicted all sorts of misery in terms of on society, on the economy, on the politics. But on a micro level, on a me level, it was kind of good because I got out of there. And if I had stayed there, I wouldn't have as good a life as I have now. So my life, my entire existence that I have now, operates in this weird moral liminal space. Because my life is good, but all that goodness is from this bad thing that happened. So it's like, is it bad that my life is good? If we take that transitive property, like, if the world were a just place, a truly just place, I wouldn't have anything of what I have right now. Like, that would be the conditions of moral justice, would be to take away everything that I have now and revert me to that life where I'm still in Bosnia and I have the good but not as good life, as opposed to the much better life that I have now that I have by virtue of this great injustice that happened. And so that fact makes me acutely aware that at a fundamental level, I don't really deserve anything of what I have Because as I just mentioned, in a truly just world, I wouldn't have any of this. Everything that I have, all my good fortune, is a function of injustice, of this very bad thing that happened and that shouldn't have happened. So, all of that is to say, defining who I am and trying to understand and figure out where my past, my history of a refugee, fits into the story of my life and how I define myself and who I am and how I bridge the gap between where I come from and where I am now, has meant having to grapple with all of the fallouts of war, all of the nth degree effects. Not just the immediate ones, but all of the rippling consequences. So, where does that leave me? What do I do with all of this complicated, knotty morality? How do I go about constructing an identity and notion of myself for myself when I have all of this that I need to wrangle with? I think we have a model for it. I think I have a model for it in the Mandalorians in Star Wars, because they are also having to grapple with how to create a life in the aftermath of war and displacement and how to define themselves. And we see a couple of different solutions for that among the Mandalorians. So one key element that we see in Mandalorians is that a lot of their heritage exists in material form. So as we see in both the animated series and in live action, The Mandalorian, Mandalorians place a great deal of importance on their armor and on Beskar in particular. On the one hand, that is for practical reasons, which this armor has very practical benefits, as we've seen on the shows. It can deflect blaster bolts. It can deflect lightsabers. That really comes in handy if you're a warrior race. But at the same time, in addition to having that practical value, it has a very strong sentimental value. It has very significant cultural value, especially for those Mandalorians who live in diaspora. So if we think back to, for instance, in Star Wars Rebels in Season 4, when they're on Mandalore and they learn about the Duchess and the fact that it can target Beskar armor, there's a point where Ezra suggests, well, why don't you just get rid of your Beskar armor? Why not just make your armor out of something else? And Sabine has this line where she tells him, Ezra, the armor I wear is 500 years old. I reforged it to my liking, but the battles, the history, the blood, all lives within it. And the same goes for every Mandalorian. And then her dad chimes in, this armor is part of our identity. It makes us Mandalorians who we are. And we see this also echoed in The Mandalorian. So for instance, in Season 1, when Din returns the Beskar that he's gotten from the client to the armorer, she remarks, quote, this was gathered in the Great Purge. It is good it is back with the tribe. And then Bo-Katan, this is a line that I mentioned back in episode 12, when she first meets Din Djarin, she says, this armor has been in my family for three generations, emphasizing that familial link the same way that Sabine does. And we also see with the armor in Season 1 at the end, when Din and company are fleeing Navarro, they try to get the armor to leave with them, but she refuses to leave the forge until she salvaged all of the Beskar and melted down all that armor. So we see just how important it is to the armor, and it's also, of course, important to Din, and we see that in Season 2, when he goes to Tatooine and he finds Cobb Vanth with the Boba Fett armor. He insists on getting the armor back from Cobb Vanth, to the point where he's willing to fight him to get the armor. And so for the Mandalorians, having that armor, having that stuff, that Beskar, that material link to their heritage is incredibly important. As I said, particularly important for those Mandalorians who are away from Mandalore and have no other link to their homeland. And in that same way, material goods have also been an important link for me back to my own heritage and where I come from, and have been part of how I have incorporated my own experiences as a refugee into my own identity and my own story. So I've got a shelf, actually not too far from where I'm recording right now, where I have a bunch of different mementos from the former Yugoslavia. So basically things that belonged to different members of my family. So I've got a collection of pins that's from my mom back when she was a kid that she collected. I have a set of prayer beads and headscarves that belong to my great-grandmother. I have a medal that was given to one of my great-grandfathers. I have another assorted set of items. One of the realities that I've been cognizant of diaspora, and this is true in my own circumstance, and I think is true for lots of people who have been forced to flee their homelands, wherever they're from, is that a lot of material history, a lot of that material linkage to your past, to your identity, to your heritage, is and will be lost. So I think about this in the context of my own family. You know, I've got one set of grandparents who are still alive. That's on my mom's side. My dad's parents have passed away. But I think about, like, once all of my grandparents are gone and their houses are packed up and people are clearing out their homes, like, a lot of that stuff that they have will probably get tossed because there is no one and nowhere to keep it. Like, a lot of the extended family, myself, my dad's brother, other cousins and so on, they've all left Bosnia. They're not there. Like, there are very few people around who can be stewards of this stuff or have the space to keep it in their apartments or their homes. So a lot of that is just going to get thrown out. So a lot of, like, family photos and things that people consider heirlooms, things that would have gotten passed down, like, all that's going to be gone. And it's not going to get passed down to the next generations. And you're going to have that big, like, severing there in terms of the generation that grew up before the war and then the diaspora generation. Like, all that's going to be gone. Like, I think about in the context of my mother's side of the family with her parents, my grandfather, so her father, he has this typewriter at their home because my grandfather was a literature teacher. He was also a poet, a published poet, and he has this typewriter that he used to write. And, like, I already have in the back of my mind, like, one day when he unfortunately passes away, like, I am prepared to, like, duke it out with whoever I have to duke it out in my family to get that typewriter. Like, I will pay whatever I have to pay in terms of shipping to get it shipped from Bosnia to me. Like, that's my beskar right there. Like, that's one of those few precious things that I can hold on to that is from my family, that is from my heritage and from my legacy. And so those precious few things that we've been able to hold on to, that we've been able to either get or were able to carry on, like, all that stuff's super important and super valuable. So since we're on the subject of getting a hold of and holding on to objects that are rare and valuable and that provide this link to your own family and to your own past, that offers a really good segue to talking about what, for my money, is one of, if not the most fascinating and compelling characters that we are introduced to in the second season of Mandalorian, particularly in the context of this conversation, and that is the character of Boba Fett. So something that we see in Mandalorian Season 2 that really links it well with all the other Mandalorian storytelling that we have in canon is that it adds to our understanding of factions and divisions among the Mandalorians. So we're introduced to the Children of the Watch, the group that Din Djarin belonged to, and how their particular beliefs are different from mainstream Mandalorian beliefs. And the season overall does a lot in terms of exploring these issues of what does it mean to be a Mandalorian, who is in, who is out, what's the criteria for belonging and such. And Boba Fett fits into that story in a really, really fascinating way. So Mandalorian Season 2 adds some really interesting layers to the character of Boba Fett and really builds on things that we already know about him from other media. So on the one hand, as we know, Boba Fett is a child of war. He loses his father, Jango, on Geonosis at the start of the Clone Wars, and he is orphaned, much like Din Djarin. That is something that the two of them have in common. And what we see in the second season is that Boba has a complicated and precarious relationship to Mandalorian identity. He's neither a born and bred Mandalorian like a Sabine Wren or a Bo-Katan, but neither is he a foundling like Jango or Din. So, for instance, we have that exchange in the season finale when they go to pick up Bo-Katan, where Bo-Katan tells Boba, "You are not a Mandalorian," and Boba replies, "Never said I was." At the same time, even though he doesn't have any sort of Mandalorian lineage in that respect, the fact that he was neither born on Mandalore or any of Mandalore's associated planets or moons, and the fact that he's not a foundling, he still at the same time has a claim on Mandalorian heritage. He's still part of the lineage of the Mandalorian people. And that is through his father's armor. And that's why he wants to get his father's armor back. And that's why he chases Din all the way to Typhon to get it back. So in other words, Boba is someone who straddles two worlds. He's got a foothold in the world of Mandalore and the Mandalorians, but he's not a full-blown 100% Mandalorian. He's also got one other foot in the larger galaxy. And for that reason, because he occupies this middle space of being partway in and partway out of the world of Mandalore, that makes Boba a prototypical immigrant kid. And I guess you could even say a prototypical refugee kid, because he's technically a refugee of the Clone Wars. The Clone Wars make him a refugee. And you can really see that in the way even that a lot of fans have talked about Boba Fett, both before Mandalorian Season 2 came out and then even during Mandalorian Season 2. I think a lot of people, without realizing it, were engaging in immigrant discourse around Boba Fett. So all the stuff that was happening around Boba Fett back before Season 2, when his return was just still a rumor, and then even going into Season 2 when we knew for sure that he was coming back, all the questions about, like, well, he wears Mandalorian armor, but is he really a Mandalorian? He's just a clone after all. All of that, that's all immigrant discourse. That is all conversations about issues of belonging and inclusion and identity. And if you take those three things and you put them on a Venn diagram and then you look at what's in the triple intersection of that, it's immigrant kids. It's people like me. Folks like me are, throughout our lives, we have been asking ourselves these questions because we also have been straddling two worlds. We have a foothold in the world from which we came, from which our family came. But then we also have a foothold in the world of wherever we ended up, whether that's America, whether that's another country. And so we ourselves find ourselves asking questions about, who am I? What am I? And related to that, much as with the Boba Fett discourse, comes questions of authenticity. What does it mean to be authentically Bosnian, Chinese, Cuban, whatever? And do I, as a kid who left that part of the world a long time ago, do I fit the criteria? Can I really say that I belong to that particular cultural tradition or heritage or whatever? So all that stuff that people are asking about Boba Fett is stuff that immigrant kids and people who are first generation, people who are second generation, are also engaging with in their real lives. And what we see with Boba Fett, and this is true in the context of, again, a lot of immigrant kids, a lot of people in the first generation, a lot of people in the second generation, is that Boba in The Mandalorian has to prove his claim to the Mandalorian heritage and also has his claim to that heritage and his authenticity challenged at several points. So, for instance, in the tragedy, when he first goes to get Din's armor, Din, as we know, initially doesn't want to hand it over because he doesn't see Boba as a quote-unquote true Mandalorian. And then ultimately, at the end of the episode, he has to pull up the chain code in his armor to show Din that, in fact, it belongs to him and that he's got this connection to this quote-unquote true Mandalorian, Jango Fett. And I think even there, that's something remarkable. Like, if you think about the symbolism of the chain code, like, he's literally a part of the armor. The armor is literally a part of him. He has imprinted himself into the armor. It is a part of his heritage. Again, going back to that point that I made a few minutes ago about the stuff that links us to our past and to our family. He's in the armor. His chain code is in the armor. There's a powerful metaphor there. And then the other moment that it happens is a couple episodes later in the season 2 finale at the very beginning when, I was referring to the scene a couple minutes ago, when Din and Boba go find Bo-Katan and the other Mandalorians to get them on the mission to Moff Gideon. And there's that confrontation that Boba and Bo-Katan have. So what we see in that scene is that Boba and Bo-Katan have different and, in fact, competing signifiers that they place on Mandalorian armor, on what it means. For Bo-Katan, the armor is a sign of membership. If you are wearing Mandalorian armor, that means you are part of the Mandalorian people, and it means you're part of the team. It's this statement of belonging. It's the symbol of belonging. And so when they're talking about their mission, and Bo-Katan brings up going back to Mandalore and reclaiming Mandalore, and Boba Fett basically goes like, Mandalore? Like, you want to go back to that shithole? Are you kidding me? When he says that, for Bo-Katan, that reads as a betrayal of what the armor stands for. Because for Bo-Katan, if you're wearing the armor, that means you're part of the team. You're one of us. You're committed to the Mandalorian people. So that's why she has the immediate reaction when he says that of, you are a disgrace to your armor. But that's not what the armor means to Boba Fett. What's clear in that scene is that Boba Fett doesn't have any sort of sentimental attachment to Mandalore. Mandalore isn't home to him. For him, the armor is about this linkage that he has back to his father, to Jango Fett. He doesn't think that by having the armor, by wearing the armor, he's bought into the Mandalorian 9 yards, that he's now one of them, because he doesn't see himself as one of them. And in fact, what happens there ultimately in that scene is that Bo-Katan is challenging Boba's claim to his armor, and by extension, Boba's claim to Mandalorian heritage through Jango Fett. So she does it with that, you are a disgrace to your armor line. And then Boba Fett responds back, this armor belonged to my father. And then she replies, don't you mean your donor? So she's basically saying, this claim that you are making, that like you have this armor by virtue of your father, he's not really your father. You're just a clone. He's your donor. So what Bo-Katan is doing in that scene, what she's basically saying to Boba Fett is, you're a poser, dude. Like, you're not one of us. You're strutting around wearing that armor, but you don't really belong. Your claim to that armor is totally illegitimate and invalid. And even though personally I've never had an experience like a Boba Fett in that scenario where I've had someone like call me out or try to like challenge my claim to my heritage or anything like that, I've definitely had the questions about and asked myself the questions about authenticity and belonging. So you know, all that stuff that I talked about earlier in the episode, the fact that much like Boba Fett, I feel alienated from this place from which I originate, the place from which my heritage arises, and the fact that I don't have a particularly close relationship to my extended family, and I don't speak their language, and I'm not immersed in their culture. Like, I've definitely asked myself those questions about, well, am I authentically Bosnian? Am I, in fact, just a poser? Am I really part of the team? So that's definitely been something that's been internal to me. In the case of Boba Fett, we get an external example of that. We see somebody else calling his claims to his heritage into question. And I think at the end of the day, what I find so fascinating about Boba Fett, besides the fact that I feel like he and I share some similarities in our past in terms of having this kind of precarious relationship to this heritage to which we claim, and not really neatly fitting into one side or the other, is that Boba, in certain ways, offers a model. He offers a solution at the end of the day. And I think you can see it, again, symbolized in the armor. So what we see with Boba Fett is that he changes Jango's armor on two occasions. So the first goes from the prequel trilogy into the original trilogy. He takes the armor from the original Jango color scheme, the blue and the silver, and then it goes to the color scheme that we see in the original trilogy with the green and the maroon and the yellow. And then he changes it again a second time in The Mandalorian when he gets it back from Din Djarin, that it goes from the beat-up look to the fresh paint look. And I've seen a lot of people talking about the symbolism and the metaphor of the paint change, particularly the second one that happens in The Mandalorian. So people have brought up how it symbolizes Boba kind of turning a new leaf and becoming a new person. I've also seen people breaking down the actual color schemes and then talking about the symbolism of the colors and what the particular colors mean. But I think if you look at that paint change, that color change, from the immigrant lens, if you take that perspective, I think there's an additional added layer to it. Because what we see there is we're seeing Boba Fett figuring out for himself a solution to the immigrant kid problem, this problem that vexes people like me about trying to figure out how and where you belong and trying to integrate your past into your present sense of self. So what we see is, on the one hand, Boba is, by holding on to Jango's armor and by chasing Din across the galaxy to get it back, he is honoring his heritage, he's honoring his father by wearing the armor. But he's not keeping the armor the same. He's remixing it, and he's changing it to suit himself and his own look and his own taste. So he's taking that heritage and then adopting it to his own particular context and situation and individualizing it. And there's a Sabine Wren line that I quoted towards the beginning of the show when she was talking about the importance of Mandalorian armor, where she talks about doing something very similar with her armor. And I think there is a kind of model for how folks like me can go about their own lives, which is that we can take aspects of the culture and heritage from which we come, whether that is language, whether that is clothing, whether that is food, whether that is music, and we can remix it and we can adopt it into our own particular situation in whatever country we're living in. We can fuse that past with the present culture of America or wherever else you happen to live and create this new hybrid thing that suits our own particular needs and preferences. So I think ultimately the promise of Boba Fett, what I think makes him such a compelling and fascinating character, makes him a kind of role model for folks like me, is he holds the promise that at the end of the day, people like me don't have to choose between where we come from and where we are, that you can have a foothold in both worlds and ultimately be secure in it. You can have your own armor. You can wear the armor of your father, but you can make that armor your own. And you can feel comfortable enough and secure in yourself enough to be able to do that. And that is ultimately my hope for all folks who are in my situation, who are themselves immigrants or refugees, and find themselves in this kind of gray zone in terms of identity and belonging, that we can all be a Boba Fett, and we can marry those two sides of ourselves and make them a coherent whole. And then ultimately, the last time that we see Boba Fett in season 2 of The Mandalorian is in that post-credits scene after the finale, where he ultimately leaves the gang. He doesn't continue on with Din or Bo-Katan or whatever they're doing, and he instead goes back to Tatooine to retake Jabba's palace and basically sit on his throne. So I think, again, there, to connect back to what I was just saying, like, I think, again, for folks like me, for the immigrant kids, for the refugee kids, I think there is another kind of model there, which is that he's got this linkage to the Mandalorian past, and he's had that challenged, and he's proven that he is worthy mantle of the Mandalorian heritage. But at the end of the day, he doesn't join up with the Mandalorians. He doesn't join up with Bo-Katan's cause to retake Mandalore, this place to which he doesn't have a connection. At the end of the day, he carves out his own path. He goes back to Tatooine, the thing that he knows, and he goes on that particular journey, carrying with him the lineage and the legacy of his father, and by extension, the Mandalorian people. And I think that's the ultimate hope for all immigrant kids, is that in whatever endeavor, in whatever future we have, that we ultimately are able to carve that future for ourselves, and that as we carve that future for ourselves, we are able to take where we came from along with us, and we are able to carry it along without shame, without feeling the need to hide it, without feeling the need to defend it to other people or to prove ourselves to other people. And I think that is the promise and the model of Boba Fett, and why I think he is an even more compelling character than just the guy who wears the cool armor and kills stormtroopers in a really cool way. I think he embodies the lived experiences of many, many people. So on that hopeful, optimistic, forward-looking note, I will wrap up this discussion. So I want to conclude just with some two final thoughts, basically of a more meta nature. First is that probably of all the episodes that I have done up to this point of the show, this is the one that I was maybe most nervous about, and really for two reasons. One is that even though the story that I've just told and everything that I've talked about has been firmly rooted in the world of Star Wars and is connected back to the world of Star Wars, there was a way in which I felt like I was going towards the outer boundaries of what a Star Wars podcast is and can be. And ultimately, that is part of the goal of this show, is to really kind of push into that terrain and do stuff that people don't expect and don't see coming and don't imagine that a show like this can do. But I think in doing that, that carries a certain amount of inevitable trepidation in terms of thinking about how is it going to land and how are people going to receive it and are they going to see it as too far afield. So that was a bit of the source of the nervousness. And then also just the fact that this is far and away the most personal episode that I've done to this point, where I'm really kind of cracking the door open to my own life and my own experiences and my own inner psychology. And so laying that out to all of you, the listeners who have come to listen to a podcast about Star Wars, that comes with also a certain amount of anxiety in terms of reception and such. And then the second meta thought that I want to add is that, and in this context, I will be, of course, adding my own voice to a very large chorus of other fans and content creators who have been making the same point and reiterating it over and over in so many contexts over the years, which is that ultimately what I hope is one of the takeaways of this episode and of this show is the importance and the need for all people who consume Star Wars to be able to see themselves in the final product and to feel that they're ultimately represented by the characters and the stories that are told and the importance that can have on an individual. You know, this goes back to the Force Awakens episode that I did a couple weeks ago with Meg Dowell. We talked about this at length. Well, she really talked about this at length. That I think so often, at least in certain circles of the fandom, in more negative circles of the fandom, issues of representation are treated as quote-unquote political or like advancing some sort of agenda. And of course, that's not the case. What it's really about is, and I hope that this episode kind of illustrates that, is that it's about creating richer and deeper stories and about creating richer and deeper characters. I don't know at the end of the day, and I highly doubt it, that Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni, when they were creating the story of Mandalorian Season 2, or even Dave Filoni when he was working on Clone Wars or Rebels and telling the story of the Mandalorians, that they at all were thinking about Yugoslavia or the refugee experience or any of that as they were crafting the story. Maybe they were. Maybe that did cross their radar in one capacity or another. Maybe it didn't. But the point is, Regardless of that, they crafted a story that allowed someone like me to see a parallel to what I was seeing on the screen. And that has enriched my connection to that story and those characters. So somebody like Boba Fett, even if I had none of those personal connections to Boba Fett that I talked about just now, even if for me all he was a dude with cool armor who killed stormtroopers in a really cool way and had a really cool ship, I would have still found him an awesome character and would have liked him a lot. But the fact that I have all of that, and I have this personal connection to Boba Fett where I can look at him and say, hey, there's a guy in fiction whose life and whose struggle and whose experiences mirror stuff that happens in my life. That's next level. That puts him in a totally different plateau than any other character who I may also really like and find cool and awesome, but I don't have that personal connection to. So my hope for Star Wars moving forward is that all folks, regardless of how they identify, whether you're talking about lines of race or gender or sexual orientation or gender identity or nationality, are able to find characters and storylines where they're able to make similar connections, where they're able to see someone and say, hey, that's me. I'm in that story. That person is going through what I'm going through or what I went through. Because at the end of the day, that's how you create invested fans. Like, I really, really care about Boba Fett because I want to see what this guy who is like me, what's going to happen to him. And so the more fans you get who are able to say that about more characters and about more storylines, the more invested and more passionate fan base that you are going to have. So this is not about some agenda. This is not about placating certain people who are making complaints. This is ultimately about creating better stories and creating deeper stories and creating a fan base that feels invested and that's going to stick around in the long haul. And that's why representation matters. That's why we have to tell these stories that people connect to. I just wanted to end on that point because it is sort of the elephant in the room in telling this story, and I felt I couldn't really end it without addressing it. So, what to expect on the next episode? So episode 14 is going to drop on January 31st. And on that episode, we will be taking a look at deleted scenes in Star Wars. So there's a lot of material across all of the saga films that, for one reason or another, didn't make the cut, didn't make it in the final movie. And on this episode, I'm going to take a look back at some of my favorite deleted scenes and some of the, in general, more notable deleted scenes out of Star Wars, and talk a little bit about like why they didn't make it in, or like why wouldn't they have worked, or just talk about like why they're funny or why they're interesting. And also a few deleted scenes that, in my opinion, should have been in the final cut of the movies and would have added to the story had they been in there. Until then, make sure that you're subscribed to the show. Rate and review the show if you are able to do so. If you're not already, you can follow the show on Twitter @ALargerViewPod. You can also follow me on Twitter @DMondum. And until next time.